A Christian Education Sunday Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan on September 7, 1986, entitled, What Do These Stones Mean? The scripture readings are Joshua chapter 4, verses 1 through 8, and chapter 24, verses 14 through 17, and Psalm 78, verses 1 through 8. The texts for the sermon are Joshua 4, verses 6 through 7, and chapter 24, verse 15, and Psalm 78, verses 6 through 7. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, I've been studying and preparing myself for the course that I'll be teaching this fall, the course entitled Civilization, which is being offered here at the church on Wednesday evenings, but which is also being offered through Grand Valley here at the church on Thursday evenings for credit for those of you that need some continuing education credit. It's a subject that has always fascinated me, and it is my peculiarity, my oddity, my idiosyncratic nature that loves the history of ideas, and I love to see the bridges between theological development, the religious life, and the broader cultural scene. So as I have been studying that and reflecting upon that, I have been aware again of those words of Ruskin, which are printed in the educational booklet, that the history of a people are written in three books, in the book of their words, in the book of their deeds, and in the book of their art. And he says, although no one book can be understood apart from the other two, the most trustworthy one, he believes, is the book of a people's art. That tells where their heart was, where their values were, and in the history of Western civilization, that is so closely tied in with the faith and life of the people as it came to expression in the Christian tradition. And so for me, the history of civilization is very much a tracing of the development of Christian faith as it manifested itself in the larger cultural scene, and I happen to be fascinated by that. I do believe it is possible in the book of a people's art to come to an understanding of that people and what was important for that people. And so I am looking forward to that particular exercise, which I think will give us a sense of God's rule over all. Too often we get ghettoized in the church, and we see the movement of the Spirit of God on a very narrow track within the church itself, rather than understanding that His Spirit blows across the face of the earth and moves through the course of history in its totality. And so that's the kind of thing that we're into. Now, I know that doesn't really turn on everybody. I love Europe because I guess I love to trace that line, and you can trace it in churches and cathedrals and monuments and statuary, and that, I suppose, is why I love to return again and again to the womb of Western civilization. But I do know that it isn't everybody's cup of tea. I remember years ago taking a group of people to Europe, and we finally arrived in Paris. We were there on Sunday, Trinity Sunday. What a glorious place to be on Trinity Sunday. One could make one's way to the great Notre Dame, and in the midst of the glory of its stained glass and the grandeur of its organ and the atmosphere and all of the associations of that place, one could worship. But then, being a very liberal tour leader, I have to always give an option. So while I was painting the wonders of Notre Dame and the possibility for worship, I said, and for those of you for whom that may not be your thing this morning, there's also a flea market. Half of the group went to the flea market. Can you believe it? Notre Dame, Trinity Sunday, stained glass, organ, worship, and people went to the flea market. Well, like I said, not everybody is odd like me. But I don't suppose that that is so bad. But I didn't want anybody to miss at least seeing the great cathedral. And so in the afternoon on the city tour, we drove up to it, parked right next to it. All one had to do was to get off the bus and go in and see it. And when everybody was off, I looked and there were still four there on the bus. I said, "You're not going in?" Jake said, "You've seen one, you've seen them all." He did get off the bus finally. He went down to a souvenir shop and bought himself a gaudy tie with the Eiffel Tower on it. Now, could you believe it? I mean, you can do that. You can do that. You can live with a full life, but your life may be as shallow as a thimble or as deep as a 10-gallon bucket. And I want to say to you this morning that you have before you a wonderful opportunity in which to tap the rich resources that are ours to grow as fully alive, fully human beings. And that's what this message is all about. It's simply a call and a challenge to grow and to avail ourselves of the treasures and the resources that are ours as the people of God. In the whole course of the Christian tradition, there has always been the call to tell the story. There has always been the necessity of repeating to the rising generation those things that make us what we are. Sir Kenneth Clark, in his book, The Civilization, begins in those dark periods, and he entitles that opening chapter "By the Skin of Our Teeth," because he recognizes that Western civilization was just within an inch of going down the tubes, because civilization is always only one generation away from the loss of all of its treasures. And of course, that's true of the church as well. God has children. God doesn't have grandchildren. All we need do is miss one generation, and we've lost it. And so in the church, we have constantly been reminded that we must remember and that we must keep the story alive, keep telling it, and keep passing it on. And this is, of course, the significance of that Old Testament lesson from Joshua. Whatever happened at the Jordan, Joshua taking over the leadership from Moses, who had looked at the promised land from afar, now led that people into that land. It was the fulfillment of the promise of God, the promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And now they were standing on the threshold of it, and they had to move through the Jordan and take possession of the land. And whatever happened on that event, Joshua never wanted them to forget that it was the grace of God that was bringing them in. And therefore, he was instructed by the Lord to have the place established and signed with a sculpture. 12 stones set up. Well, if you read the story, it's a little confused. I'm not sure if they wanted it in the middle of the river or in the camp of the first night or maybe both places. But the point is clear. There was to be a stone sculpture on the spot where future generations could come back and could visit, staying in the motel, the Holiday Inn at Gilgal, and moving over to the Jordan on occasion to see the stones and hear the story about how one day God's people went through the Jordan River and came into the land. When your children ask you, "What do these stones mean to you?" then you will have an occasion to tell them how the Lord brought you into this good land. And very simply, that theme is reiterated time and again through the Scriptures, and its point is eminently clear. We are to share the story and pass along our faith and the tale of God's grace to the rising generation. It has been given to us as a gift. It is to flow through us and to be shared with a generation rising and with children yet unborn. When your children say to you, "What do these stones mean to you?" Tell them. Tell them about the mighty hand of God and His gracious deliverance from Egypt and His bringing you into this fair land. I remember so very vividly, well, it's a story that I've shared with you before, but when you stay in one place for 100 years, you have to keep repeating yourself. But every time I come to this Sunday into a subject like this, I do remember the Sunday morning at 326 Eunice Avenue, Parchment, Michigan, the screened-in front porch, my father sitting in the rattan rocking chair with a red flower cover on it, and I jumping into his lap when my mother was preparing the Sunday dinner, saying to him, "Dad, when can I have that bread that you got at church this morning?" Now, it was just an innocent child's question. Every kid wants to have a shot at the bread when it goes by. And because we haven't understood how we ought to in our covenant understanding of things include them in the table, we do it here, but too often we've passed them by. I was one of those little kids that didn't get to take the bread. And it was innocent enough and unspiritual enough coming from me. But you know what my father did? Tears started to come down his cheeks. Now you know why I'm so odd. An innocent question from a child, "When can I have the bread?" All I wanted was a snack at church. But he knew that from the depths of his being, what he was praying for was the day when I would take that bread and say, "I believe his body was broken for me." It triggered something deep inside him, so that it brought a tear to his eye, because all he really cared about was that I would come to that kind of personal knowledge of God through Jesus Christ. When your son says to you, "What do these stones mean to you?" take it as an opportunity to tell him. To tell him about the good things that God has done. Psalm 78 is a rehearsal, a recital of the mighty acts of God throughout Israel's long history. It's a long psalm. If you look at Psalm 78, it's a long psalm. It's the kind of psalm that made me groan when on one given evening I saw that we were reading Psalm 77 and knew the next night it would be 78. I'd have to postpone the ball game another 10 minutes. It's so long. I always love Psalm 117, two verses and out to play. But we read the whole thing. I can't believe we read the whole psalm. But the recital of God's grace and the history of the people is told in this story. And the challenge at the beginning is to keep telling the story. He laid on Jacob a solemn charge and established a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach their sons, that it might be known to a future generation, to children yet unborn, and that these would repeat it to their sons in turn. There's at least four generations right there. Why? He charged them to put their trust in God, to hold His great acts ever in mind, to keep His commandments. Why? Because there had been a generation that had failed, And the consequence was they had no firm purpose, and their hearts were not fixed steadfastly on God. Now, what I hear the psalmist saying is simply this. Tell the story. Recite the history. Witness to the grace of God in your life, so that each succeeding, rising generation, hearing the story, will come, number one, to put their trust in God. Number two, will have a knowledge of His acts, of His saving acts, of His redeeming activity. They'll know the story. Number three, so they'll obey, so that they'll follow the commandments of the Lord, which are not heavy and grievous, but which are the path of life. In order that, and if we take the negative away and put it into a positive, in order that they might have a fixed purpose, a firm purpose for their life, and that they might fix their hearts steadfastly on the Lord. Now, what else could you ask? How much clearer could the charge be? Tell the story, so that there will be developed within the child fundamental trust. Through a knowledge of the story itself, issuing in obedience, so that the life may have purpose and meaning, and the heart be fixed steadfastly on God. It's as simple as that. And the meaning is so clear. You can trace the history of a people and the manifestations of its cultural life. When you go through Europe, the thing that strikes you are the towering church steeples in every landscape that you look upon. I always led ABC tours of Europe, another bloody church. Never passed a church without going in and standing and wondering. But the thing about that landscape, it points to a time when there were a people who lived in an age of faith. I have seen those periods criticized by some historians who said the poor, poverty-stricken peasants didn't have potatoes for their platters, and they were told by the church to bring their few paltry cents to build those piles of stone. Well, what a naive, what a superficial understanding of the human spirit it is. Because a poor peasant can live with potatoes on his platter, but he can't be fully human without a vision and a wonder and a glory of God before his mind's eye. To build a church is more important than to eat well. To offer up all that one has for a pile of stones that tells where my heart is far superior than to be well-groomed and well-fed and to be a part of this affluent consumer society which is ours. I know what they believed in 1300, 1200, 1400. I can see the pile of stone. What signs will we leave? What will it be? The sign of 1986, the sign of the 20th century. Will it be a glass office building? What will be the signs that we leave in the sands of time from this generation of which we're a part? I saw at least one of the specials on TV this past week on life on Crack Street and the horror of the affliction of the drug plague that's sweeping the country. But why are young people looking for a high? They're looking for a high because inside they're hollow. Because they are not prodigal, but the children, the sons and daughters of the prodigals. So that they no longer even know the question to ask, or the means by which to identify that boredom, that emptiness, that meaninglessness within. So, we are a people richly blessed, having been told the story, having committed ourselves to the story, and having the opportunity to keep telling the story. I have just gone through two pregnancies, vicariously. I am the proud grandfather of two lovely ladies born within the last 3 months. I began to feel like a patriarch last Sunday as all three of my grandchildren were there. I know that during the 9 months of pregnancy, I prayed daily, thinking about how much was at stake, praying that all would go well, that the development would be normal, that the birth would be in good order, that the child would be well. How much rests on that? Then the feeling of exaltation, of exhilaration, of praise and gratitude when you see this marvelous little life and stand in awe, the miracle of a child born anew. And I was reflecting on what do I really want for them? What do I really want for them? I want for them to live with a fundamental trust in God. Trust is not something you gain along life's way. Trust is something you bring to life. If we just turn them loose and let them figure out whether they will live with trust or mistrust, they'll never come to trust, because life is a mixed bag and the ingredients are mixed and the message is mixed. You don't come to trust from the encounter with human experience. You bring trust to human experience. I want my little girls to be able to face any day and any circumstance, to go through any hell, with their heart fixed steadfastly on God. That's how they'll get through. I want them now, even now, to come to the development of that fundamental trust that will enable them to go out and face come what may in any circumstance and any light or any darkness and say, nevertheless, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless His holy name. I want them to know that God is for them, that He has graciously reached out in Jesus Christ. And I want them to respond in love to Him and to their neighbor. That's all. It's as simple as that. Heart set steadfastly on God. And an environment of grace, living in love. And all the rest is negotiable. The youngest in the clan graduated yesterday from Georgia Tech. So while he was graduating, I wrote him a letter in which I reminded him that all of life is grace, and whatever gifts one has are precisely that, gifts, to be responded to in gratitude and responsibility. And then the closing shot, knowing that this was probably the last time, I said, and give God the preeminence. And the other pieces will fall into place. Because my young entrepreneur son has visions of conquering the world, and well he might, but I would not have him gain the world and lose his soul. That's all that matters when you get right down to it. I wonder why I had to get so old before I understood that. Old Joshua got his job done, and then he gathered all of Israel around him, and he said, "Now look, remember all that the Lord has done." And again, he recited that history. He said, "You're going to have to decide whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord." Sometimes we get tired. Sometimes we get weary. Christ Community has been a haven for those who have been burnt out in other congregations, coming here with tongue hanging out, panting, hardly daring even to enter the door of a church again for fear that they'll have all these heavy burdens laid on them again. This is a place to be anonymous and to find a balm for burnout. And all of us have different kinds of stages that we go through. Like the boy who heard his mother call on Sunday morning, "Get up! Time to get up!" No response. 15 minutes later, "Get up! You'll be late for church!" No response. Finally she came 15 minutes later, shook him, and said, "Get up! You'll be late for church!" He said, "I'm not going. They don't like me, and I don't like them. Give me two good reasons why I should." She said, "Well, you're 45, and you're the pastor." No personal reference intended. We all get tired sometimes, and maybe we've been out in a little backwater just healing, and that's okay. It's okay just to be here. One of the blessings of being here is to get that heavy-handed oughtness off our back. But old Joshua also knew that even as an elder statesman, it was important for him to make his commitment anew and to serve the Lord. Well, this old elder statesman in your presence this morning joins himself to Joshua and invites you to join him in making a new commitment. "As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord."